So this week I've got Tim Riley has popped in, writer. Only seemingly research tells me he's only ever worked in good places. Never stepped into a bad place for some reason. So I'll be grilling Tim on his career for the last 30 years. You're looking like you're doubting that. Or do you not want it public that it's been 30 years? We could say 20.
Settle for 30.
Let's say 20. So we normally kick off with just saying, where were you born?
I was born at St Mary Abbott's Hospital in Kensington.
Okay, sounds very posh.
I think it was before they knocked it down. Its claim to fame was that that's where Jimi Hendrix died.
In that hospital?
Yeah.
Okay. Kensington. Were you a Kensington posh kid growing up?
I didn't get a chance because pretty soon after that, my parents moved to, moved to Wembley and then to Hillingdon. So we moved to the burbs pretty quickly. So cool. I suspect it was like now that if you try and live in London with a child, you can't really afford to do it. You have to move out. So that's what happened with them, I think.
Okay. So what was the first ad you can remember ever seeing?
I can remember lots, actually. I couldn't...
The usual batch of John Webster classics, like Cresta Bear.
Yeah, Cresta Bear, but... I can remember loads because in those days there was only one commercial channel and you didn't get to watch much TV. So you kind of devoured everything, I think. So adverts included.
So what would have made an impression on you as a young Wembley child?
Everything, even the bad ones. I mean, I don't know if you remember, you're probably too young to remember the big match.
Yeah.
Remember the big match?
The big match.
Was
the ITV football show, the big match.
Was ITV's Sunday afternoon football show.
Yeah, I remember that.
So they had, it was like Match of the Day, but a day later. So if you were a kid like me, you couldn't watch Match of the Day, but you could watch the big match on Sunday afternoon. And being a programme aimed at blokes, the ad breaks were full of ads for tyres and small cigars and beer and stuff, and petrol. So I remember Put a Tiger in Your Tank and Goodyear GH100 tyres with unique water-clearing aqua jets, just because I saw the ad so many times. Do you remember Mannequin Cigars?
Yes, it's funny. Dave Waters, I think, mentioned that from growing up. Obviously made an impression
It would make an impression on anybody. And Bird's Eye ads in particular, which I later found out were done by CDP, because we, you know, like I suppose kids still do today, we would recite them in the playground. And so you mentioned Cresta Bear, of course, everyone did the Cresta Bear thing in the playground. And also there was one Bird's Eye ad for beef burgers that was set in the Roaring Twenties with Sandra Dickinson in it. Do you remember Sandra Dickinson?
I do remember Sandra Dickinson.
And she's in
the one with the busty... but high-pitched voice.
Yeah, she's in a restaurant with her boyfriend in Chicago in the 1920s. And
she get carried out or something?
She says, what are we going to order? And at this point, a bunch of guys with violin cases come in and her boyfriend looks a bit edgy and says, we better make it something fast. And she says, well, why don't we try Bird's Eye beef burgers? They're nice and fast. And she sees that the gangsters have got instrument cases, which are supposedly concealing machine guns, and she says, hey, they got a band, which was a hilarious joke.
That was a pretty funny joke in the 70s.
So there was that one, and there was also one that was set in a medieval banqueting hall with two serfs turning a spit with a roast hog on it or something, and one of them says to the other, one day, Thomas, meat will come in little boxes. And he has this kind of dream sequence, and you cut to a kind of what was then present-day Bird's Eye braised beef in gravy in a cardboard box, which is what people used to eat in 1969. And 1969 is important because that was the year that man landed on the moon. And the other serf says, yeah, yeah, right, and one day a man will land on the moon. And everyone laughs at this guy for... this ridiculous flight of fantasy. But of course the joke was man had just landed on the moon. You might want to edit that one out. It was hilarious at the time.
That's a great anecdote. That's the kind of anecdotes we keep rolling for. So you remember those in quite distinct detail. They obviously made an impression on you at the time.
Yeah, worrying.
And they're not like the famous ads that you see at D&AD every year where they show Alan Parker's reel or something. They're quite...
I think Hey They Got a Band is still a... Yeah. You know, was on... when D&AD did a 21-year reel. That was on there, I think. Or perhaps I just imagined it. But that was an interesting thing in later life when I first discovered D&AD annuals, to go through the TV section and go, hang on, I remember that from when I was a child. You know.
So did any of those, do you think, lead to you wanting to get into advertising or...?
No, I didn't even think about it.
What did you want to go into?
Being incurious by nature, it never occurred to me that somebody was responsible. Yeah, there's an actual job. I just thought they kind of happened, you know. They came with the TV, maybe.
So what did you go to college?
I did a foundation course. I've kind of mucked around at school a bit and didn't really want to go to university, and because I could draw a little bit, not very well, but my sister had signed up for a foundation course at the local technical college. I thought, well, I could probably do that. I could muster enough qualifications to do that. So I did a foundation course.
In what was it?
I found it in geographically or
no in not the location but the what was that in advertising or graphics or
well foundation you kind of did a bit of everything, so it was mostly fine art drawing, you did a bit of sculpture, fashion and textiles, which is quite interesting. Yeah. Bit of graphics, printmaking, you did a bit of everything really.
And at what point was the switch to advertising? Or did you consider that?
Well, I kind of realised pretty quickly I wasn't good enough, although I'd probably had enough talent to get in. I wasn't very good at drawing compared to other people. I wasn't very good at art. But in the library there, I discovered D&AD annuals and saw the graphics section. And I thought, well, graphics looks like something you could do and you don't need to be able to draw to do it. So maybe I could do that. So I then applied to do graphic design at an art college and got accepted to do that. And then, again, realised that graphic design was quite hard work, because in those days, before the Mac, you had to do all your layouts by hand. Mm. Typography involved tracing out type by hand on detailed paper.
Yeah. It's a certain sort of...
Which is fascinating.
Mindset that can do
a certain
that.
Sort of mindset, and, you know, I'm sure I learnt something from it, but... Again, I thought, well, if you do ads, you just have to write the idea down and that's pretty much the end of it. So
true for you writers.
That seemed like a better option to me. So it's more born out of laziness than anything.
So it's funny, lots of people are the same, that they've got into it via being able to draw, which is funny now because nobody can draw and it doesn't seem to matter. But
to be honest, I couldn't really draw then and I can't now, but... I could draw just well enough to get me onto the first step, I suppose.
Okay, so you've figured out that it's less work to go into advertising. You just have to jot down the ideas. What did you do next? How did you go about getting in?
Well, the course I was doing was graphic design, and once I decided I want to have a go at advertising, my tutors, to their credit, said, well, we can't teach you that. I read about the D&AD advertising workshop and they said, well, just start doing that. You know, we're quite happy for you to, we'll give you a degree. If you do the work, we'll still give you a degree. So do the advertising workshop.
And did you see anyone well-known at the time? Did they take that, like Dave Trott or Hegarty or whoever? Who would have been taking that?
Trying to think. We saw lots of people. Who did we see? We saw Paul Smith and Mike Everett at CDP. We saw Judy Smith and Peter Matthews at CDP.
Barry Smith? Just thinking, going through all the Smiths.
No, didn't see Barry Smith. But we saw lots of people and, you know, I think Peter Souter said this, but I kind of owe everything to D&AD, really. Not just having the annuals as a record to pore over and try and absorb the way in which ads were done, but also that course was fantastic because you had access to all these great people whose names I now can't remember once a week for 6 weeks, and you got proper feedback. Because I don't know what other art colleges were like, but the one I went to, they were just so nice. You'd have to, they'd set you a project for 2 weeks, and even if you came back with nothing, they'd still say, well, I think you've got, there's a germ of something here. Yeah. You know, this is, well done, well done.
Yeah.
Whereas once you were showing your work to people in advertising, they were a bit more critical.
Harsh.
And actually, to the college's credit, one of our visiting tutors was Alan Midgley from Saatchi & Saatchi, who's a great art director and advertising person. And he came down and did two one-day sessions with us. And it was brilliant because he would literally look at people's work and say, this is terrible. Why have you done this? Shouldn't it be, what if you did so-and-so instead?
Mm.
And I think those of us who were interested in advertising thought, well, this is good. You know, it's kind of quite a bracing
yeah, it must be a shock experience. To the system after the tutor.
To have someone say, no, you shouldn't do that, you should do this. So that was quite good.
It's funny, most of the people I've spoken to so far have all gone through the same system. They've done a D&AD course and then they've absolutely obsessed over the D&AD annuals, which I can't think that people are doing now. I don't think people are obsessing over the awards as much now as they used to. Perhaps because there's so many and it's so diverse. And I don't know, even know whether the D&AD course is still going in the same way. I presume not. Is it? I don't hear of it anymore. I don't hear of it, any of those things continuing, you know.
I don't know. I suppose it was a more insular business. It was, although I guess eventually you were aware of ads being done in other countries, it was, D&AD was entirely focused on the UK. They had an international section a bit later on, but so the business was really about, I don't know, 8 agencies in London, and that was it. It was quite a small world, so not only was it, was the annual smaller and more manageable, you probably could obsess over it because the sections were smaller, but you know, there were 8 or 10 places that were good. And
it allows me to name drop, which is when I talked to Tom McGallagher, he said the same thing about the American shows, that him and his partner would walk through, they'd go to New York and they would walk through naming ads, and the other one would have to give the credits to them.
Yeah.
You know, it's a sort of same kind of mindset, even though obviously the biggest business was enormous. It's that obsessive mindset that seems to connect the people I talk to. And I don't know, I don't see that as much now. I don't know whether that's quite as obsessive. There's obviously a lot more creative outlets now, maybe.
Maybe they're obsessive in different ways. I mean, like I say, I think it was probably easier to, especially when print advertising was so much more a part of what people did. That seems easier to kind of work out how it fits together. And I don't know. So perhaps it lent itself to obsessives more, whereas maybe now.
Yeah, it's a lot more complicated.
I don't know.
So how did you go from the D&AD course to an actual job?
Well, the good thing about D&AD, the course, was it gave you access to these people. So if you'd had a particularly good week, well, let's say a not bad week with one of the people who set the brief and then critted your work, you could then ask them at the end of the evening, could we come in and show you our book? And we did that a few times. And also, I think in those days, you could just ring people up, whether you'd met them before or not, and say, can we come in and show you work? So I was at college in Maidstone, which is only an hour by train from London. So we'd quite often come up for the day and just, we'd ring up in advance and say to people at agencies, can we come in and show you our work? And we never got a no. One time we were at a loose end.
You'd ring them up on the day?
No, we'd ring them up a couple of days before. So you'd plan out a day and you'd see maybe 2 or 3 agencies. And one time we were at a loose end. We had maybe an hour before our train went back to deepest Kent. And we said, well, why don't we go to GGT? So we literally just turned up in their reception and said to their receptionist, we're a student team. This is the middle of the day. Will anybody see our book?
Amazing.
And the receptionist said, oh, hang on a minute. And she said, yeah, there's a team that will see you. And Pete Gatley and Nick Ray went through her book, you know, for about an hour and said,
amazing,
that's rubbish, that's good, change that headline, do this. I don't know if that kind of thing still goes on, but it was just amazingly helpful in those days.
So how did you get to be, how did you get into BNP? So BNP at the time is interesting. There seemed to be like a golden generation of grads with yourself, Tony Davidson, Mark Waits, Nick Gill, that all seemed to start in a similar period.
I think it was...
was that good hiring by Alan Tilby? What was the...
I think it was good hiring by Alan Tilby. We did a dîner d'evening with Joe Wenley and Patrick Collister for... I think the brief was whatever rum brand they had. Can't remember. Dry Cane, I think,
right.
Which was like a kind of poor man's Bacardi.
Yeah.
And we did some not very good ads for that. But halfway through the evening, Alan Tilby, who was the Newcrest director, kind of wandered in and, you know, looked at the work, which again is something that, I don't know whether that kind of thing happens these days. If an ECD, as he would be now, would have time to do that kind of thing. But anyway, he came in and looked at the work and blah, blah, blah. So... a couple of days later, we rang up BNP and said, oh, could we come in and show Alan our book? And there were two Alans working at BNP, so they assumed we meant Alan Curzon, who was a writer. So they said, oh, yeah, come in and see Alan. So we turned up a week later, and they showed us into the office of a completely different Alan. So we were briefly a bit crestfallen, but Alan Curzon and Simon Hunt, who was his art director, were two really nice guys and were very complimentary about the work. And they said, can you stay here for a second? We'll just go and get Alan Tilby. I thought, oh, yeah, that was the guy that we meant to see in the first place. And he came back, didn't seem to remember us, but liked the work. And he said, do you mind if we show this to John Webster? We went, no. So, I mean, as I remember it, they then took the book away again, showed it to John, and they said, well, would you like to come in and... do a bit of work? Would you like to, you know, we'll put you on a 3-month trial? And I said, yeah, I'd like to do that. So that's how we started. But as I said before, I think in those days it was a much smaller business. And not only could you ring people up and get to see them, but it was probably just much easier to get taken on, you know.
Presumably partly good timing. You can only imagine something to happen that quickly. You're in with one team, then the creative director, and then the ECD, and then all of a sudden you're there for 3 months.
But not knowing too much about BNP's situation, I think what had happened is that it was maybe a year after, or a year and a half after Dave Trott had left. Graham Collis, I think, had been CD. He'd left and gone to Kirkwood's. So, and Tilby, I think, had only been, I think Tilby was Graham Collis's replacement. So he was hiring people, basically. Mm. We didn't kind of know this at the time, but the agency was just kind of reforming itself a little bit.
And was that within that same year that all those people joined?
No, they joined a little bit later, but Frank Budgeon was there working with Bill Gallagher. Tilby was working with a guy called Colin Bedbruth, who then left, and Paul Leaves came and joined Alan. And then pretty soon, in short order after that, Nick Gill and Alan Howell joined. Dave Buchanan and Mike Hannett joined from TBWA. Tony and Kim joined, Mark Waits and Neil Pavitt. So all the people that you were all hired amazing. Within the next couple of years.
So presumably you become a bit like a gang and then also competitive, which is helpful.
Competitive, but also, I mean, whether it's partly because we're also terrified of Paul Lees, I don't know, but you'd show each other your work, so, and everyone was quite
Why was Paul Lees terrified? Because Tony, when I talked to Tony, we were sort of joking about how inappropriate most of his comments are, you know, and I was relating that, I was reminding him that when he first turned up at Liga Stellini in his first week.
Davidson?
Yeah. Tim came in. And he slapped him on the back and said, don't worry, Tim, we'll teach you how to do TV. That was in Tony's first week. So I thought, God, this guy's unusual.
What was Tim's reaction?
He sort of smiled and carried on walking. So I think, but there's a sort of number of those.
Probably the right way to approach
it. There's a number of those kind of comments that I kind of relate to him, Tony. But then when Paul Eaves come up, he said, I didn't say anything inappropriate to Paul Eaves. He made the point that that was not an option. So what was he like, Paul? Because obviously he was a great creative and art director.
He was great. I mean, he and Tilby were a great team, and they hired great people, and they got the very best work out of them, I think. So he was great. But he was also, I don't know, 6'3", worked out. So he was an imposing figure, both in terms of his talent and his physical stature.
Right.
So, your ad had better be good when he went into show.
And Alan was presumably opposite, short, not really a worker-outer.
I don't know. I never saw him go to the gym, but I wouldn't like to impugn him in that way. But he was Tilby was brilliant as well. Was someone to learn from as a writer. That department really.
Basically, taught you to write, did he? So presumably before then, you were sort of on the cusp of being an art director / writer, and Tilby took you under his wing.
I wouldn't say that, but he perhaps because there was more time in those days or because you had a bit less work to do, you could take your attempts at body copy in to see the CD, who of course these days would be an ECD, and they would have the time to sit and read it and come back and tell you what they thought was wrong with it or what stuff. I mean, on a kind of line-by-line level, yeah. Whereas I don't know if people still have the time to do that. People probably don't write copy anymore. So it's probably not an issue,
they don't write the batch of words at the bottom of press ads, but they write tons of words and everything else.
Yeah,
and I've just written something about this, which is the fact that there was a story that I found about David Abbott taking his copy in to John Withers,
mm-hmm.
and he talks exactly about that line by line thing, and he's he'd say John. The minute he would turn up at the door, John Withers would get his pencil out, as if there's never going to be a big reason not to use this.
Mm-hmm.
But then after a year or so of doing that and John pointing out things that were obvious, he would start to leave the room without any pencil marks on his paper.
Yeah.
And I don't know how people learn to write anymore. That used to be the process. You obviously did that with Tilby. Lots of people did it with Tim, whoever. But I don't know how people learn to write anymore. I don't know how they learn to figure out what words to choose, how to shorten things, how to structure arguments. Because I think writing's used more now than previously. It's just not in those little slugs at the bottom of ads,
But it still happens somehow because, ads make sense and in whatever form they are. So somewhere along the line, somebody's doing that job, I suppose. There was just more writing in those days, I guess, because the lion's share of what you did, particularly if you were a junior, was probably written stuff. But it was an enormously helpful department to start in, so we were pretty lucky to start there. Everyone you went to, nobody would turn you away or say they were too busy.
No. And what did he teach you, Tilby? Yeah, I've never met him. I've heard of him talk to like a natural talent is the description that comes out. It's almost...
I think he'd had a period out of the business because he was a hotshot young writer in the late 60s, I think, at Saatchi's and CDP, and had a very hot run. And then because it was the 1970s, whether he, it was the kind of thing that he did, I think he bought a farm or something and had just come back to the business. So he'd probably only been away for a couple of years or 3 years, but in those days, that seemed like a long time. So he was like a returning figure, I suppose. So, he was great.
And what was the first good ad that you made, or the first ad that you thought, I can do this, or it made an impression?
I don't know. It took a while, I think. It took a while for various reasons, but...
Well, I've made a note of the first ad that got into DNAD,
mm-hmm.
and the headline was Thames Day, June 25th. How did you come up with that one?
Yeah. Well, I got put together with Joanna Wenley. Patrick Hollister left, and again, to my great good fortune, they they said, you know, maybe you should try working with Joe, who was who seemed amazingly wise and experienced and all those things. And she's actually probably only about 3 years older than me, but she'd been there for 4 or 5 years. So, I mean, that was a brilliant opportunity to work with a grown-up senior art director. And we had the GLC, the Greater London Council, which doesn't exist anymore, which was abolished by the Thatcher government in 1984, I think. And the GLC only at the last minute realised it was under threat and decided that they needed to advertise why the GLC was a good thing and why they shouldn't be abolished. It was too late by then. But Tilby and Leaves, John Pallinson, Pete Gatley did a brilliant campaign, an anti-abolition campaign, which won a gold for print in 1985. But the GLC also did, what was it? Thamesday. They also
Thamesday,
did.
Yeah.
They also did, you know, entertainment-based things, and there was a budget to do underground posters, which came to Joe and I. So there wasn't very much writing involved, but basically, I think our idea was in the tradition of the classic underground posters. We'd try and commission some of the best illustrators of the day to do posters, and we offered one to Bush Hollyhead, who turned us down. But he said, "What other things have you got coming up?" And I think Joe told him, and he said, "Oh, I could think of something for Thamesday." And so when that brief came up, we gave it to him, and that got in for illustration. But I don't know about you, but I wouldn't count a craft award as particularly one for illustration as anything to do with me, as you said.
As the writer, I don't know. I think you got there was a few things in that year. I noticed there was Thamesday. There was a, I think it was that year, there was an internal race day game for BNP.
Well, that was one of your other routes into the book, I think, in those days. Maybe it still is that advertising agencies would do, there's a category in the graphic section of their wars called items of self-promotion.
Yeah, that's right.
And BNP, because the B in BNP, Martin Bowes, was a big horse racing fan. The agency's annual party was a day at Lingfield Races. So every year there was a brief to do the official invitation to all the staff and whichever clients went. And it seemed like every year that got in the book. So when we got it, we thought, well, this is a chance to get something in the book. Mm. Not in advertising, but just to get in the book is pretty good. And to get in the graphics section, some validation for the 3 years I spent doing graphic design. So.
Also, in those days, pre-internet, pre-blogging, anything like that, that was the only way to get noticed. So all those little chances of an internal brief for tickets for a race day or whatever it is, was the only chance you had of getting noticed. So in that time, BNP seems to have gone through about 12 iterations from BNP, I'm trying to think of all that they would have been, Reeves Robertshaw, BNP DDB Needham, BNP DDB. How many of those BNPs were you there for? How many mergers did you
only
see
two.
Through?
When I was there, it was BNP for about 5 years. Then BNP took over. BNP went public in about 1985. So everybody got shares based on length of service. So you know about Mary O.T.?
I know Mary. Well, I knew Mary O.T.
Yeah. There was another tea lady there before her who, because of the share policy, she got a huge amount of shares, so when they went public, she became the rich tea lady. Because she had, I don't know how many shares she had, but she was worth a lot after that. So they went public. Then I think then maybe they overreached themselves a bit. I don't remember quite what happened. They took over Davidson Pierce, which was another agency. And then I think they hit a bit of a rocky patch, and then BNP were reversed, taken over by DDB. In about 1989, 1990. So for a long time they were, I mean, I left around that time, but for a long time they were BNP, DDB, and then eventually they just became DDB, I think.
So Mary O.T. when we set up CDD,
yeah,
we'd arranged to hire Mary O.T., little known story.
Your first hiring?
Our first hiring was going to be a tea lady.
Yeah.
As partly as a PR stunt, mm-hmm. and partly because we really like Mary O.T., and partly because it just shows how clueless we were, that we would lure away Adland's most famous tea lady. So it was all lined up. It was all a done deal. She was pushing for arguing over the money.
Do you want a car as well?
And there was debates over them. We had a lot of meetings with her. And I don't know whether it was something to do with the tester thing falling apart, but obviously we didn't do with it. But at one point, that was our first hiring, Mary O.T.
Very wise.
That's obviously essential for most. Why did that agency not work? When you go in with thinking like that. So at some point, you did a joint project with John Webster, Texas Tom. How did that work? Is that sitting in a room with John? Is that writing a script that he engages with?
What he used to do was, okay, he would do maybe three or four things a year, or all TV. Some he'd do by himself. And others he'd get people to help him. So we worked with him on Hofmeister Bear. I don't know if people remember that, but when lager advertising was big, he did a campaign with where he created a bear called the Hofmeister Bear, George the Bear. We did a couple of those with him. And then one day he said, oh, can you help me out with this? I saw this guy last night on Wogan. Terry Wogan used to have a early evening chat show three nights a week or something. Or maybe it was on the radio. But anyway, he said, I've heard this guy, and he sings this song called The Devil Inside, and it's about how the singer tempts some housewife at home during the day or something. And he said, I thought we could use this for Texas Home Care. And we're sitting there thinking, how's that going to work? But he'd rewritten the words of the song, The Devil Inside, which is all about I'm the lust she can't hide. It was probably quite a deeply dodgy song. But he said, I've invented this character called Texas Tom. I'm Texas Tom, and I'm going to tempt this woman down to Texas Home Care, which is like a kind of B&Q DIY store, with the promise of 20% off shelving or something, which seemed quite funny. He said, I've had a go at writing a couple of scripts. Could you help me write a couple more? And so we said, yeah. And in some ways, that was the most fun I ever had in advertising, because one, because someone that handed you the idea, and two, because what you were trying to do really was just make funny rhymes out of things they had.
Stuff they had in Texas.
Yeah, what's a funny rhyme for orbital mower?
Yeah.
You know, and
it's a good challenge.
It was, and he got the guy over from Texas, who I don't think was a big country and western star.
Oh, it was the same guy?
The same guy came over, who was a recovering alcoholic, so he'd only drink coffee and stuff, but... And he was even taller than Paul Eaves. He was about 6'5" and wore a Stetson and everything. And, you know, we approached the first recording session with some trepidation. I thought, well, is he going to think, like, we're taking the piss? We've rewritten the words of his song to talk about charcoal briquettes and stuff like this. But, no, he seemed to really enjoy it. So, just good fun, really.
And how was
silly words for songs.
John working with that throughout that process? Was he sort of controlling? How did you engage with him on that?
He was pretty good, I think. I mean, it was kind of a gift because, like I say, he'd pretty much come up with the idea, and he'd written two or three scripts and said, see if you can write a couple more. And it was the days before cut and pasting, but he took some of our lyrics and put them into some of his scripts, and we did radio as well. And... yeah, it was quite a generous thing for him to do, I thought.
So some of my favourite thing probably that you did at BNP would be the John Smith posters, which
I still think
you could probably run tomorrow. They still look...
Do you think?
I think you probably could, yeah. I mean, it's a really good idea. I've got a vague memory of you telling me it came from a Goodies annual. Is that true?
It wasn't a Goodies annual, no. It was Mad. I don't know if they still do, but Mad magazine you used to be able to buy over here in a kind of anglicised version, but in bookshops they used to sell paperbacks that were like compilation
yeah, I've got
books
some of, those.
Of Mad American Mad magazines from the late 50s and early 60s. So when, for some reason, when I was about 10 or 12, I got very into Mad magazine, and we would go to W. H. Smith in Uxbridge, and occasionally help ourselves to the odd, because who would suspect an 11-year-old of a shoplifting?
You'd think he's just eating three cigarettes or regular.
And we would occasionally help ourselves to the odd Mad paperback. And it was in one of these Mad paperback books was this idea of half-finished billboards. So it would be where the guy had kind of only half-pasted up one side of the poster. So it might be a toothpaste ad and a drain cleaner. So you'd have half of the toothpaste ad that would read, clean your teeth, and the other half of the poster would read, right down the drain or something.
Yeah.
And one was a dog food ad, and one half a dog food ad and half a whiskey ad. So it said something like, dogs love the taste of Calvert Reserve whiskey.
Yeah. Great.
So I mean, that's something that was kind of buried in. Sorry?
I think they work great, those. They did then, they do now. I still think they're really good.
And it was like a last minute thing. Dennis Willison and Julian Dyer, who were kind of like the star team in that young department, had a really quite a good campaign that was based on famous Johns. But I think at the last minute, the client decided that they wouldn't stump up the money to use famous people in it. So it was a bit of a panic brief. So we got the brief with about 3 days to do it in. And I just thought, oh, there's that. It's the kind of idea you could use for almost anything, actually. But I thought, well, I wonder if you could do some John Smith's ads with that. And that's what we did.
And also around that time, you were working on the AIDS, tackling AIDS.
Yeah, we did some
really good stuff on that.
Yeah, did some AIDS ads. That was, so I think the first campaign was done by TBWA, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. They did all the big marble slab stuff.
They did the big, Don't Dive Ignorance.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether that was a separate piece of the of the campaign, or whether it just moved from TBWA to us, but ours was much more about, that was like frightened people.
That was oddly scary,
yeah,
but probably didn't engage people.
No.
Whereas yours was more intelligent, thoughtful, sort of,
well,
different
the,
way.
The brief was to try to persuade people to practice safe sex, I suppose, which is a difficult thing to do.
Particularly then as well.
Particularly
that's a long
that time
ago. Yeah.
So I'm not sure whether they were successful at all, but
I think they got people thinking.
Interesting
more
thing to write about. And it meant you could legitimately use the word masturbation in a headline.
Yeah.
And in fact, when we
went away to an award somewhere,
when we went to present that particular ad to one of the clients said, yeah, I like it, but I'm a bit worried about this word in the headline. I thought, oh, here we go. He said, couldn't you change masturbation to wanking? I said, well, I think you could, but then I think that might just stand out a bit too much. You know, it's enough of a surprise to see masturbation in the headline. Wanking might be a step too far.
So you talk them down.
Talk them back from wanking to masturbation.
So why did you decide to leave BNP? It was obviously, you obviously did very well there.
Well, it's probably the first of many poor decisions, I think. It just got to a point, I'd been there for 7 years, and I thought, well, it's probably time I should move on and go somewhere else. There wasn't any particular reason to leave, I don't think. I mean, the DDB merger had just happened, so the agency had changed a little bit, but not for the worse in any way. Tony Cox had joined, who was great, and the department was still very strong. But I don't know, it just seemed like 7 years in those days seemed like an unimaginably long time. And I thought, well, maybe I should go somewhere else. And I was aware of Chris Palmer and Mark Denton's work because they were like kind of meteors across the advertising sky. And they had just set up their own agency. And a friend of mine, Andy Mackay, who I'd been at art college with and who'd followed me to BNP, had left a couple of years before and ended up at Simons Palmer as their first, the first creative they'd hired. So they offered me a job there, and I thought, well, it'd be quite interesting to go to a smaller place.
So you were probably the first senior person they hired, weren't you? Because generally they hired people like me who'd been nowhere and not done anything at the time.
I think there was one other team there. Sean Doyle was there.
Yeah.
So Sean was there.
But Sean would have come direct from Poulter's, I think.
I think he'd come from Poulter's.
So generally, they, I think Tony Barry may have been there. But it was generally people from bad agencies. Paul Silberman, myself. Whereas you'd done a lot of good stuff by that point.
So Andy was there. So Andy was working on and off with Sean. And there was a team called Paul Diver and Keith Courtney. And then Chris and Mark. So I worked with... So poor Sean kind of worked in an office by himself. And lived on... I think he was still commuting. He was living... His family were in Leeds still.
Yeah.
I think he was commuting and living in a one-room flat somewhere in London and eating Ravita and cottage
and
cheese.
Weird diet.
And just churning out thousands of headlines. And Andy and I were next door to him in the office next door. It was a bit of a shock, because coming from BNP that had its own cabinet maker who would make you... every time you moved to a new office, the guy would come and build you a new plans chest from scratch and hand dye it in the agency colours.
Oh.
On my first day at Simons Palmer, the office manager came in and said, what kind of shelves do you want? And showed me a catalogue, and I went, well, those ones look quite nice. And the next day, the box just arrived in my office, and you had to assemble it yourself.
And was this in the new Lego-type building that they went in Knoll Street?
Yeah.
Blimey. So how many people were there at the time? Must have been very small.
I think it was about 40 or 50 people.
Right. So that must have been a big culture shock from, what, 400, 300 at BNP?
BNP was probably about 250.
Right.
So, yeah, it was quite small.
And how did you adapt to that? Because obviously, knowing what Chris and Mark were like, they were, I would imagine you would have had a lot more freedom at BNP. Whereas when I was at Simons Palmer, they knew what you were doing 24 hours a day. They were on top of it, generally for a positive effect, but it was a very different environment.
They did, but as I think you say, it was in a positive way. So they were involved in every piece of work. But just because of the size of the agency, we had maybe 7 accounts. So the lead times were all quite long. So you get a brief in plenty of time. A piece of work would be chosen and possibly sold to the client, but it wouldn't run for another couple of months. So ads were put on the wall as sold, but if someone can beat this, then it was up for grabs. And Chris and Mark, to their credit, you know, occasionally they'd come up with an ad for something and someone else would beat it, and the ad that beat it would run, you know. So it's good in that way, but there wasn't a lot of work to do, whereas there was at BNP. And I think another of my possibly unwise moves was to look around and think, well, Nike, where's that going to go? Because we were doing maybe 3 or 4 Nike print ads a year. And
where's that going to go in terms of how good could that be? Or,
well, how much work there is. Because in those days, most of the work was done by Wydens in Portland. And we'd just get the stuff that for football the Americans didn't know how to do. So we got an Ian Rush ad, we got the rugby ads, and... But it was like, and the London Marathon ads we got to do, and it was, but there wasn't very much work. So I thought, there's no future in Nike at Simons Palmer.
Little,
and of course,
like
within about a month of leaving, huge amount of briefs came in. And
but it felt like you evolved that from when you first started working on that in the football business to the marathon ads. I think, was it a marathon ad that said, if you're going to go to hell and back, travel first class, which is sort of quite English, quite Legacy Delaney-ish, to Isaac Newton, Neil, Michael Jordan 1, which is much more where they ended up going once you left, and was great. a great ad. But there seems like a sort of slow evolution from this sort of slightly quieter English way of doing things to a much more ballsy. Were you trying to evolve it, or were you just tackling each brief as it came? Because you did a lot of the early Nike stuff, didn't you?
I think it was
on a platform once you'd gone to take advantage of what had been done.
I don't know about that. I think it might just have been adjusting to writing posters better. That the marathon ad, the headline's probably way too long to be in a poster. And the penny probably dropped after 6 months that a poster needs to be a bit more immediate than that. And also, I mean, that Michael Jordan ad, we were literally sent the transparency from Portland.
What, one shot that you had to use?
Yeah, one shot.
So what, you had the shot?
I think it was a black and white shot, I think. Okay. So it was a caption writing contest for me. So okay. Andy Mackay got the shot hand-tinted, and it was like, what headline can you put with this?
Oh, okay. So you had a blank space to fill in?
Pretty much, yeah.
It's good. It's good filling in.
And I'd read this, because in those days, I might be wrong, but I'm not sure people really knew that much who Michael Jordan was. But I used to buy, not quite sure why, but I used to buy American Esquire. And there was an article in one month's American Esquire about Michael Jordan. And there was a sentence in there that talked about his ongoing dialectic with Isaac Newton.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know what a dialectic was, but I thought, oh, that's an interesting way of thinking about it, because, of course, the famous thing about Michael Jordan was hang time, that he seemed to hang in the air. I thought, oh, OK, well, maybe there's something in that, so if you just shorten that.
Yeah.
It might even have been, without giving my secrets away, there was a John Smith from the 1970s where the end line was John Smith 3, Tchaikovsky 0.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
So I thought, oh, you could use that construction for Michael Jordan. And so it's kind of pinched from John Webster, really.
That's excellent. So how long did you spend at Simon's Palmer?
Probably about 18 months.
Right. Maybe Why so short? Because, again, you've done a lot of it. You've done all the Railway Museum. There's a ton of those.
Yeah, I mean,
a lot of Nike.
Having said that there wasn't that much work, I suppose we did a fair amount, but I don't know.
You've done the British Art Foundation?
Yep, done the British Art Foundation. Although those didn't turn out that well, I didn't think. I don't know, I wasn't really that happy with those ads.
Well, it was all stuff that turned up in awards in some form or another. I mean, it's quite a lot, in 18 months, quite a lot of... I would have thought most people would think that's going pretty well.
And there wasn't much TV either. I mean, the TV was few and far between. So it made perfect sense.
To go to Liga Stellini.
Going to do more TV to go to Liga Stellini, which was famous for its lack of television. But
How did that come about?
It wasn't a very well thought through move either, I don't think. So poor strategic decisions throughout my career.
So how did that turn out? How did that come about then? Did Tim approach you? I thought you'd be perfect
Tim Delaney had rung me up when I was at BNP and said, you should come and have a chat. We've been monitoring you, or we've been, you know. I went, oh, okay, that's okay, I'm flattered. So I went and met him and Steve. And
together for your interview?
Yeah. And they talked about the place and what kind of work they were doing, and I should go and work there. And I, maybe. But I think at that time, the thought of just doing print possibly put me off. But I don't know. After a couple of years at Simon's Palmer, I thought, I'd like to go somewhere else. Where can I go? And rather feebly, I thought, well, Ligas were interested in me. I wonder if they still are. So I spoke to Tim, and he said, yeah, come to Liga Stellini. But as I said, it just meant even more print, which I should have foreseen, really. And the thing I hadn't really realised about Ligas was they were largely a retail agency. I mean, like the world's greatest retail agency, but their three biggest accounts were Nationwide, Harrods, and what would the other one have been? Timberland, maybe?
God, I'm trying to think at that point.
Certainly Harrods.
Guardian, they used to do. It's not really retail.
Harrods and Nationwide. who pretty much needed ads every day.
Yeah.
So you went from Simon's Palmer, where you'd do an ad and it'd sit on the wall for 3 months until it ran, to Legas, where you'd get your status report every morning from the traffic guy.
That would give you your days.
Would give you your day, and you'd have a review on Nationwide at 11 o'clock, Harrods at 3 o'clock, and Timberland at 5.
Well, funnily enough, that's a little bit more... it doesn't sound as crazy now. In those days, that was... I mean, when I first went there and you were expected to do ads in 2 hours, it seemed absolutely ludicrous.
But it's doable, though.
But it's doable. Once you get your head round, it's quite fun.
And the
Yeah.
So what was it like when you were there? Did you have a similar kind of...
Well, it's funny. I was remembering my... as you were talking about seeing Steve and Tim, I remember my first interview with them, which was with... It's funny, I did the same thing, which is I went from Simon's Palmer to Legas Delaney, and I also, because Tim had offered me a job when I was going to Simon's Palmer, I also followed it up exactly as you did, when for a different reason.
What was your reason?
They'd fired Chris and Mark. So Tony Barry was going to come back to work with me at Simon's Palmer, and he was at Legas Delaney, and then... I kind of thought, I don't really know what's happening here. So we got in touch and said, look, why don't Tony stay there? I'll come there, because he wanted to take me a year before. But the first time my interview there, I went in with a portfolio to see Steve and Tim, and they got all the work, the laminates. They sort of shared them out. Occasionally, Tim or Steve would show the other one an ad, but there would be nothing on their face. So you didn't know whether he was showing it to say, this is horrific, or this is a little gem. There's nothing. Nothing was said. Just occasionally ads were shown to each other, but I didn't know whether it was because they were terrible or good. And I remember at the end, Tim said...
Because they were good.
Well, I don't know. So at the end, Tim said, okay, I think there's certain pieces of work in here that have reached a certain standard.
He's normally so generous.
That's how he put it. There are certain pieces of work in here that have reached a certain standard. I didn't know whether that standard was poor or where that was. So thanks very much for coming in. So outside, you think, oh, I don't know if he really hated that or liked it. And it turned out they quite liked it, you know, but there was no clue in the room. There was nothing said, literally nothing said.
But you seem to make a real difference to their output. That when I was there, you were effectively executing work to a template that had already been set by Steve, which, and I think someone, didn't someone do a spoof ad or made some wry comment in campaign or something that the most important job at Legas is being in charge of the logos, because if you could accidentally put the Harrods logo on the Timberland ad and it would look the same, whereas the work that you did with Sean and Tony, I guess because a lot of it was Adidas, every ad seemed to look different and was much fresher. And
I don't know. That was Jerry Moyer had said that comment about Legas famously, and I think as an art director it seemed not to be true. You know, there were similarities, I guess, but they were very different looks and feels at the time, and very successful. And I would have thought, on some level, as a writer, that would be a joy, because they were all that Steve would set up a look that was sort of acceptable towards juries, however you want to put it. You know, that would look very slick and professional and distinctive.
Yeah,
and then you just have to think, how do you fill those words with? How do you bring it to life with words? Obviously, it was a very particular way of working, and it has its limitations. For me, I quite liked it initially because you had to learn about typography and graphics and what you could do, because you never had any time or money. So you've got your bare hands to make an ad.
Yeah.
So as an art director, it was really useful to then understand what you can do with nothing, because loads of the ads in particularly the early days of Legas for me, probably like you, they were, you've got a stock shot, a picture of someone who's in the news, a headline, the same old, and you think, God, how do you throw these together in a way that feels fresh and new? So it was kind of good and plus you're doing so many of them, there's such a big turnover that it was really good learning. But But I think, you know, so when you were there, which wasn't long, how long were you there?
7 months.
7 months. That's unbelievable.
But you know,
but you got a ton of work out. I think if you go through the awards annuals of that period, you've got work on The Guardian, Yellow Pages, Harrods. Did you do Harrods?
Nothing that won any awards, I don't think. But yeah, so it wasn't the most. It wasn't
Adidas.
Yes, I did do an Adidas ad. It wasn't the most joyous 7 months of in advertising for me, but you know, got loads of work out, and like I said, working at that pace, if you didn't know how to write a headline before,
yeah,
you learned pretty quickly because you had all those reviews, and Tim would want to see at least 10 options for each brief. So, and you describing him and Steve going through the work, you know, brings it back to me. Exactly, that would be replicated every time you'd take them in work. They'd sit and look through it in silence, and they might just produce one ad at the end of it and say, yeah, that one's okay. And you think
so. What did you learn from Tim in that period?
Well, just what I've described, I think. You learn that, you know, because at BNP, where I started, you know, we all believed that we were being worked within an inch of our life. And even Alan Midgley, who I bumped into after a couple of years, said, oh, you're at BNP, oh, well done, but it's tough there. It's like being in the Marines. So we're all kind of dreadfully proud of ourselves for working terribly hard at BNP. But the truth was, we weren't working hard at all. You know, you'd have 2 weeks, 3 weeks on a brief, whereas at Legas, you were doing something all the time. And I think with Tim, maybe it still is, kind of a badge of honour how hard people worked at that place. You know, I don't know if people remember there was a Heineken trade ad in the in campaign one week with a picture of a smiling Tim Delaney saying, that'll do, let's go down the pub.
Yeah.
Heineken refreshes the parts of the beers cannot reach, because Tim loved the idea of working at weekends, you know.
Yeah.
Wanted you to love it as well. So, you know, in a concentrated form, I think that was a useful 7 months. But, you know, again, you were surrounded by, as at Simons Palmer, as at BNP, you were surrounded by really talented people at the top of their game. The Marshall brothers, I don't know, were they there when you were there?
I was there for about the first year, maybe.
But they were just doing loads and loads of brilliant work. Tim and Steve, the same. Giles Montgomery and Christine
Jones.
Everyone was doing fantastic work.
And were you competing at that time? I can't remember whether...
On the same
brief? No. My memory is that you got your own briefs. Yeah, it was tough, but you got your own briefs.
You got your own briefs. Well, I don't think it was time to...
No.
And it was bizarre. Everything would be... when I was there, everything was very much in the same style. Full-page broadsheet ads for everything, no matter what the product was. So one of the first things we worked on was a bizarre campaign for, like, the Cream Marketing Board or something.
I remember those. Did you do any of those?
Yeah, I did. We did a couple, but it was... The idea was that you... I don't know who they were aimed at.
I think it was... It was a really weird... But it was like trying to stop people buying fake cream. Fake cream was the issue then. Rather than fake news, the big issue in the 1990 was fake.
So the way to
fake cream.
The way to stop people buying synthetic cream was to take out full page colour ads in the Daily Telegraph saying, would Cream the group have been successful if they'd been called Phosphate Guar Gum E72 with a nice picture of Ginger Baker, Eric Clapton and Jack Bruce. And
what that meant, in retrospect.
What that meant to anyone. I can't believe anyone's...
That's true, actually. I'm going to buy a real cream from that one.
I can't imagine anyone looks at any of those ads and thought, you're right, I'll go back to real cream, thanks.
Forget all this synthetic stuff.
Yeah.
So did you worked on that. Did any of yours run? Was that one of yours?
No, that wasn't one of mine. I did quite a... I did one that was something like... you can edit this pause out, can't you? It was something like made with... It was a list of horrible ingredients and it said it's not the container, it's what's inside. Or something. It was like some kind of old advertising headline standby.
So it sounds like it was a useful experience. Obviously, I think in the end, Tim called time.
Well, they used to say in those days, I don't know whether people still understand the idea of, what was it, a gold watch. In the days when there was full employment and people worked 30 years, you used to get a gold watch after 25 years service. They used to say, at least then you got a gold stopwatch. Because, you know, it was a brutal regime. Yeah. So I fled to somewhere entirely different.
So at one point, probably around this point, Simons Palmer tried to get you back, didn't they?
No, that was a bit later.
Was that later?
That was a bit later, yeah.
Okay.
I was at BDH by then.
So how did you get? How did you end up at BBH? Obviously, possibly at its peak at the time. I don't know when you'd consider, when, in retrospect, they've been good for 25 years, but certainly around 1990 would have to be near
the peak. I talked to them a bit when I was at BNP, but nothing came of it. I wasn't sure I was ready to go to BBH. I was a bit frightened of BBH because they were so cool and all their work was so great. I just thought, I'm not sure whether I can do that kind of work.
Not sure whether you're cool enough.
No.
Well, it was that intimidating. They were supposed to have hair gel in the men's loos was the rumour at the time. And leather on the walls when you go in reception. The walls were black leather.
So, yeah, I don't know whether I was a bit intimidated by that. Whereas BNP was many things, but it was very comfortable.
Sort of blokey.
Well, not blokey, but just a really good, supportive, nurturing culture, I think. Just a nice place to be. I just thought, I don't know about going working in Soho. I was a bit scared, but needs must. And luckily, they were still interested. So I got taken on. Mike Wells worked with Tom Hudson. And they'd started the Boddington's campaign, the Cream of Manchester. And then Tom went to work in Singapore or Hong Kong, I think. So I was hired to work with Mike Wells, who'd done the famous Dickens and Jones print ads
at
Saatchi's, great art director, lovely guy. So I was Tom Hudson's replacement. So again, I kind of lucked out, really, because I stepped into, in much the same way as at Legas, where I was just handed a bunch of already successful campaigns just to keep churning more out. I got Boddington's to do. It was pretty much the first thing that Mike and I did together. So the idea had already been had, really. Which
again,
is the
cream.
Of, hmm?
Coming at cream. Just looking for links.
Yeah, cream again.
With your cream experience.
Yeah,
Vegas,
maybe that was it. Maybe that's what swung it.
No, you did some good stuff on that Boddington's. Sort of give it a slightly different spin from those first ads that set it up.
Well, tried to.
The cream of Manchester.
Yeah, I tried to. But it's a, you know, it's a great kind of zag, I suppose, for beer advertising to do it in that way. Kind of quite an audacious thing at the time. Mm. I remember the first time I saw them thinking, we can't do that with beer advertising.
Yeah, it's very odd. So good media.
Yeah.
The backs of magazines, using them like posters.
Yeah, and the TV was quite odd as well, I suppose, in those days. So, yeah, that was a great thing to work on. And
so how did you find it turning up there with the intimidating, super cool vibe, was it? As intimidating as you expected? Or
no, it wasn't as intimidating as I expected. But again, you know, another great department full of lots of stars and stuff. Everyone doing great work. Levi's was being done then. Never managed to get a Levi's script through.
And was that an open brief to the
agency? Yeah, I think it was pretty much every once or twice a year, the Levi's brief, but never managed to get one to run. But while I was at BBH, an Adidas script that I'd written while I was at Legas got made. And I think to Tim and Steve's credit, they chose a better director than I would have chosen if I'd been there.
Right.
And they made it on our behalf. And
you were credited.
Yeah. So it was pretty good. We did lots more Boddington's print and Boddington's TV, BBH.
How was it showing John your work compared to Tim or Al Tilby or Tony Cox?
Comparing it, I don't know, but He was good. He was very good, John Eggers. I mean, it seems kind of unnecessary to say it, but he's a great creative director and would push you and would suggest... I mean, maybe this is where the Boddington's thing came from, I don't know, but would push you to do things that didn't seem right necessarily, but he was...
Give us an example, what do you mean?
Well, the Boddington's film I did with Mike Wells was one that was... it was like a Cornetto ad. You were supposed to think it was... it was a script I inherited from Tom Hudson, actually. You were supposed to think it was... there was a famous ad for Wall's Cornetto that it spoofed. So the setup was you thought it was in Venice on the Grand Canal, but it turned out it was a Manchester ship canal, and the girl in the boat has a Mancunian accent and nicks what you think is a Cornetto shot from above, but surprise, surprise, turns out to be a pint of Boddington's. But he insisted that, one, that we not shoot it in Venice, that we make sure we shoot it in Manchester, which we were a bit upset about, but I think he was right to do that. And also that we use the... Because we thought, well, obviously you'd use something that sounded like the original Cornetto soundtrack. Mm. He said, no, I think you should use Caruso. You should use an old recording of Enrico Caruso singing O Sole Mio.
An odd recording?
Or old crackly recording with surface noise and everything. And, yeah, it worked. You know. But he's good, John Haggerty.
So he would...
It's not very helpful, is it, just saying?
No.
He's good.
He's good. Breaking news.
That's clear.
John Haggerty, turns out he's good. But so he would just keep pushing you in different directions. So
I'm trying to think of other examples.
It's okay. We can cut this. This is...
Don't know. Can't think of it.
That's all right. So let's have a look. You also did, at that point, which I remember being shocked at the time, the best campaign of the year, Moen Chandon.
The best Moen Chandon campaign of
the year? No, that one, best campaign of the year.
Where?
Campaign Press. Gold, best campaign.
I think it was the National Newspaper Awards.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
What shocked you about it? That it should have got that award?
That it won best campaign of the year. It was a sort of... it was perfectly good. I probably had something in there that I was bitter that...
I don't think it won... I think it won a few things. I don't think it won best
campaign.
I think
it won a very big award. I'll have to go back and check. So what did you learn...
You're still bitter about it.
Still a little bit bitter about it, yeah.
Well, it's probably a very conservative jury.
So what did you pick up from BBH? What did you take away, as the kids say? Would it be the way they... I mean, they were particularly good with style, weren't they? You know, even Murray and Chandon. He's like got a certain stylish vibe, as is Boddington's, obviously Levi's.
I think to stick up for Murray and Chandon for a minute, that Mike's choice of...
no, they look good.
Using Olivia Beasley, I think it was, to illustrate the ads in the style of Alphonse Mouillard was a good one.
Yeah.
The lines I wrote weren't very good. I was a bit of a Lucas Delaney hangover there, trying to write Timberland ads for champagne, which probably wasn't the right thing to do. But they looked okay, I thought.
No, I can't remember why. I remember at the time being surprised.
They just had quite poor lines, I think.
I can't remember what was the vibe at the time. So what did you take from there, BBH?
Well, it's got an interesting counterpoint to Legas, I suppose, that going from a place where it was all about, well, not all about, but a lot of attention on the written word and writing an entire broadsheet page of body copy about why cream is better than synthetic cream, to John Haggerty, who famously said that, you know, if you can lead a revolution based on three words, then, you know, you shouldn't need more than 10 to sell something to somebody. So his view was kind of the opposite of Tim Delaney's, really. So I guess it teaches you to be visual. So the Boddington stuff is, apart from that one line, which explains the visual look of it, is almost entirely visual. And once you have that idea, the cream of Manchester, that allows you to do everything visually, then the possibilities are endless, I suppose. Whereas if you were writing a closely argued ad about why you should drink a particular beer, you've got to start from scratch every time. Mm.
Like Tetley's, Liga's Tetley stuff.
Yeah, again, I can't believe that really sold a single pint of beer to anybody, whereas Boddington's, I think, probably did.
Mm.
So yes, there's a stylishness to the work that BBH did and still do, but it's not just about that. It's an economy of communication, I suppose. It's about having a simple idea, I suppose.
And do you think that was in the DNA of BBH? I think I remember Mark Denson saying to me, he said, it's interesting, wherever you go, it's as if there's something in the water that makes you do work that's like that agency. You can't help it. It's partly, obviously, because the creative director approves what he approves. But I just wonder whether, what was the setup that made, probably at the time, it was the best agency in town at its peak. How did that
think all the work
come across day to day?
I think all the work seemed to be not ruthlessly interrogated, but the quality control was very high, I seem to remember. There were lots of reviews, and Nigel and John seemed to be involved in almost everything still. I mean, in a good way. So you had two kind of quite stellar figures looking at certainly all the work I was involved with, pretty much. And Steve Hooper and Dennis Lewis, to a degree later on, they had more control over the department a bit later on, but kind of rigorous quality control, I suppose, which I think showed in the work. I'm not sure I got as much out there as I ought to have done, really.
And did you work in... So, firstly, did you work with Rosie a bit there?
No.
Did you not work with Rosie?
Just with Mike.
How long were you there for?
3 years, I think.
3 years. So why leave there?
Another bad choice, I think.
So you're bouncing from all the best agencies in town for the wrong reasons.
Well, I kind of thought one day, you know, when I got... Oh, because in those days, AMV was largely print. Tom and Walt hadn't done... They might have just done Tested for the Unexpected by then, but it's still largely a print agency. And I kind of thought in the back of my mind, oh, one day I'd love to work at AMV.
Had you had any contact with them apart from writing that ad saying,
"No,
David, you're great," or something? I can't remember the headline
please
exactly,
but please give me a job. That didn't work. No, but when Peter Suter was made CD, he rang me up and said, "Why don't you come and work here?" And I said, okay. So that was it, really. I was offered a job. And
so it was cash. It's hard cash that lured you from BBH.
No. Although there was a bit more cash. Yeah. I think I'd turned down a job somewhere else the year before and kind of regretted it. Because I think that was it. So I don't know. Maybe I don't know. I couldn't.
Can't think of why you did that.
I think maybe I had a poor run of work at BBH, not enough stuff went through. We did an ad for J&B with Chris Palmer, actually, which I don't think they ever ran in the end, which is a bit frustrating. Went to Los Angeles and shot an ad for J&B Whiskey that was for some worldwide ad or something. Didn't turn out. We were quite happy with it. The client didn't like it. And I don't know, maybe it was off the back of that or something.
So you were you must have been one of Peter's first hirings, if not the first.
I think we were, yeah.
Yeah. Was that you? That wasn't you and Mike, was it?
No, I went there with Gary Martin, who was also working at BBH, but he was working with Mark Goodwin.
Mm.
So I don't know whether Mike wanted to go or not, or I don't know.
And when you got there, I mean, I joined a year later. No, hang on. A couple of years later. Mm-hmm. But it seemed so grown up, almost stayed to me, you know, coming from BBH, which was all cool, and or Simon's Palmer even. It seemed so had its own vibe, which changed a bit once Tom and Walter started to do kind of different work and it evolved. And how did you find that? It must have been such a different environment to go from BBH to there.
It was.
Grown up, I suppose. It was very grown
up.
Yeah,
when we first moved there, the creative department was on two floors, I think, the fifth and the seventh. It was in a building with an atrium on the corner of Marylebone Road. And the very senior teams were on the top floor. And then the crazy young people, like myself, because I was only in my mid-30s then. So incredibly, I think we were like the second youngest, well, second or third young. We were among the youngest people in the department. There was Tom Walter, Sian Dai, Pete and Braze. We were on a separate floor with the TV department. And then upstairs was Richard and John, Stuart Baker, Tom Jenkins, Rob Oliver. People then who seemed unimaginably mature and, you know, grown up, but probably were only much younger than I am now.
Yeah.
And David and Ron. And you kind of rarely went up there, actually, because I think Peter would approve most of our ads. So rarely saw David. And then after about a year there, we moved to the building at 151. Where the whole department was on the same floor. But still, it was quite quiet. There's a big snooker table in the middle of the department and lots of empty space and quite quiet. Not that BBH was full of people shooting hoops and stuff the whole time, but it's slightly more
buzzy
environment. So AMV was a little bit staid. And although Walter and Tom were there, they were usually out of the office, either writing stuff or shooting stuff. So
did you work with David much then?
Not really. Maybe as a result of that ill-fated IPA poster that I did. I don't know.
Which we'll put that in. It says, picture of God, and it says, David Speaks, was that?
David Abbott Speaks.
David Abbott Speaks.
Then...
did he like that?
I don't think he did, no.
He didn't, really?
No. I should
too fawning. What was the problem with that?
I don't know. I should maybe have foreseen that, but in those days, like lots of people, you've already done a fantastic job of reminding people about Tom McGallagher, but there was a time in the late 80s where everyone looked to Fallon McGallagher for inspiration. Rather than using it as inspiration, I just kind of copied their style of advertising almost completely and took an old...
etching.
Sort of Dura etching of God and put a headline even set with the same kind of crushed setting in the same font. So it was a picture of God and it said David Abbott Speaks.
And that was before you were there?
Before I was at Abermead?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was when I was at BNP.
Yeah.
I didn't actually go to the talk, but a friend of mine who did said, oh, yeah, he began the talk by saying, I just want everyone to know I had nothing to do with the post.
Oh, really?
yeah, that went well.
So you didn't really work with him much when you were there?
No, he looked at, he had to rubber stamp our hiring. So we met him. So we met him then and occasionally showed work to him. So the very first time we got to work on The Economist... a bit like Chris Palmer said in one of your other podcasts, we thought, okay, well, it's our first chance to work in The Economist, which was an open brief. So I think we did about 70 or 80 Economist ads. And he went through the whole pile and said, yeah, well, keep going. There's still another week.
Uh-huh.
So he was probably right to do that. But, three or four of those subsequently ran, years later.
So it's a good set so far. You've got John Webster, Tim Delaney, John Hegarty, David Abbott. It's like the full set.
You think I'd have learned something?
Well, who's the best out of those?
Who's the best?
Who's the best now of those characters?
Well, you shouldn't compare them, really.
That is the best people in the industry until that point. That is... probably the four best people in the business.
I'm sure someone else has said this somewhere else, but it's that thing about, buy the worst house in the best location. You know, I figured naively that if you worked somewhere good, it would make you better and you'd get good work out.
So So pretty soon, Gary leaves.
Yeah.
What's that, a year in or so?
I don't know, a couple of years.
And again, Abbott Mead, over that time, you've been there now 20 years.
Yeah.
Horrifically.
Yeah, that is horrific.
But I guess that's probably felt like a couple of different ages, isn't it? From those, it must have been incredibly different when you first joined and David was just relinquishing control to Peter through the various iterations. So the next up it moves from David to Peter taking over. Did that feel like a different vibe? I know Peter obviously brought in younger people.
Mm-hmm.
Even below 35 to freshen the place up.
Shocking. I don't know, because, it changed a little bit, but then, because I didn't really work to David that much, I was always showing my work to Peter. So on a work level, it didn't seem to change very much. But yes, the average age came down, I suppose, and there was more TV. More TV got done because... You know, as we said, A&B was probably largely built on print advertising and wasn't particularly famous for its TV until Walter and Tom and Pete and Braze started doing good stuff. So, yeah. what was the question?
The question was...
Did it change a lot?
Did it change a lot under Peter, really? I know...
When did you start that?
I started in 99, I think.
Oh, as far as pretty soon after me.
Yeah,
then.
In retrospect, it wasn't that.
Okay, how did you find it then? You'd come there from...
BNP.
From BNP.
Mm.
What did you think of BNP? What was BNP like when you were there?
BNP was... just trying to think. I liked BNP. It was very sort of collegiate. I thought it was...
That's what I thought.
Very friendly... I really liked it. I think that I think that it's interesting when you say you made bad decisions to go from X to Y, because I think often it's just the circumstance at the time, you know. So there was a change from they had a doc system where it was a number of people like me in charge of different briefs as and when they come in.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sort of scrapped that and brought in Larry Barker. and it just seemed so wrong at the time that we couldn't really adjust and thought, rather than kind of sit around and moan, we should go somewhere else. Whereas I guess it would have been brought in when Larry was there, or whoever was there.
Yeah.
You just adapt to whatever it is. Yeah. But it's difficult accepting the change, you know, which I don't know whether anything happened at BBH, but... You know, a few things happen and you think, well, I need to go. But the difference between BNP and Abbott Mead was huge. So BNP was sort of scruffy, tiny little rabbit hutches that you're in. People would go to Mickey's Fish Bar, would be the glamorous location for lunchtime.
Yeah.
And then at Abbott Mead, it was all very statusy. It was
still,
all about...
even in 99.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was all about... There was lots, you know, various people had Ferraris and it would be what car park are you parking in. There was a sort of bit of cachet, whether you were in below the building, opposite the building, way down there. All these sort of things that were a bit new to me. It was all these status symbols or whether... I remember at one point at Abbott Mead, I got... someone said, oh, you're going to get a fruit bowl from now on. So I said, what do you mean? You're going to have a fruit bowl now in your room and it will be replenished with fruit on a weekly basis. So, oh, right. So that was some sort of marker that either they were happy with you or something. Yeah. I don't know.
What kind of fruit was it?
I can't really remember, but there was a sort of incident with someone in the department wasn't happy. This is...
Really?
Yeah. So this is what it was like to me. Sort of incidents that would happen. I got a fruit bowl, so you think, great, I'll get some, save me walking for an apple or a banana or whatever, which is
use
great
that time
news.
More profitably.
Yeah, I can now concentrate more on my work, think about fruit and where I'm going to get it from. So, and then it somebody said, I won't say who it was, so-and-so is really pissed off because they've been here ages and figure they deserve a fruit bowl more than you, someone in the creative department. So there was a bit of a sort of kerfuffle around this thing. Nothing to do with me. I thought, well, that's not my business. I'm not handing out fruit. And then within a week or so, this person also had a fruit bowl. So one day I came back from lunch and Walter had been to Selfridges and bought the most ludicrously big gold fruit bowl stuffed with pineapples and melons, probably paid 200 quid, and left it in my room and then got loads of desk lights shining on them. So if you walked past, all you could see is all these arc lights on this ludicrously big fruit bowl. But things like that, Matt, I'd never worked anywhere where things like that, people took any notice. Yeah. They were just, you know, you're either at Legas thinking, shit, we've only got an hour and a half left, or at BNP when, you know, my sort of instant memory would be sort of trying to do the right thing was generally the vibe of the agency is like, but is it good enough? Could we do any better? Whereas, you know, what car you drove, what kind of fruit you had. Some of those things, it was the first sort of place I was introduced to that kind of thing. But, you know, I really liked it. So I think the years that I was there, you know, it was great, particularly The Economist was obviously amazing at the time, which I used to look after. And I remember, funnily enough, today coming in, one of the campaigns that I did, just shows, I think we did about, in quite a short time, about 120 pieces of work on The Economist that ran, which was ridiculous, really.
That's amazing.
Because we did lots of campaigns, like the Venn campaign and the Notes campaign and the various other things. And one of them, and we got to the point where, because I was looking after it, I thought, I shouldn't be writing them. Stupid, really, but I sort of thought, we're doing too much. It looks a bit bad. So I was sort of determined not to continue doing Economist stuff. And one of the campaigns that I had as an idea, but thought, no, I shouldn't do that. You said you should show them that. It's really good. It's better than the stuff that's on the table. So I said, well, I don't know. We've done a few of these things with three things
the colour.
And it was a colour one. Yeah. He said, no, you should definitely show them. It's better than what's on the table, which we did. And it did well. I quite like that campaign. But I just remember you pushing me on that to show them. What a weird mindset to think, no, let's not show. I've done too many Economist ads. That seems unfair. But you sort of pushed me into that. But I think, again, Abbott Mead was not quite collegiate, but was very gentlemanly, that I remember. But status, much more status-driven.
But I think that's the right word to describe BNP. And in some ways, I regret ever leaving there because although the personnel changed, that atmosphere at BNP seemed to survive for a couple of decades, really. Seemed to be there right up until, and I'm sure it's really good now that it's Adam and Eve, but clearly there's a different thing now. But for years after I left, I used to look endlessly back at BNP and think, oh, I wish I'd stayed there a bit longer, really, because lots of good, great people there, and the work was always good, and the spirit seemed to be the same.
Well, it's always very decent, wasn't it?
Yeah. And as you say, competitive, but I always got the sense that, and, you know, the DOC, the doc thing, the fact that it wasn't necessarily hierarchical, but teams CD'd each other's work, which is kind of what was happening unofficially when I worked there. It was like your kind of filtering process before you dared to show stuff to Paul Leaves and Tilby.
And you would imagine that system wouldn't work, and it probably wouldn't work in some agencies because of the competition, but it somehow worked.
Yeah. So perhaps AMV wasn't as, while you were there, maybe it wasn't as busy as it's become, I suppose, as everywhere has become. Maybe people had more time to worry about how big your fruit bowl was, but whereas I think now, in an agency, who has the time to worry about status symbols?
Fruit bowls.
Yeah. I'd forgotten about garages and cars and stuff like that.
Yeah, so it's obviously changed in that time.
Did you see somebody posted on YouTube footage of the AMV summer party from the early 80s? And it begins with a shot across the car park and it's like a Ferrari dealership.
Oh, really?
It's all Ferraris and Mercs and Porsches and things. And
it's funny, isn't it? Because David wasn't like that, that you could tell. It wasn't status-driven, although there were a lot of status symbols, but so what are the differences that you find today compared to when you first started there? Obviously, you've got things now where you're doing tweets. And I guess the question I was going to ask with the tweets, which we were talking about earlier with the writing, is there a connection between the tweets you'll put out on behalf of clients and the words you would have shown Al Tilby? So on the face of it, I guess you'd say, well, not, it's a completely different thing. But I can't help think that lessons Al Tilby may have taught you in how to write and how to condense and how to put things together still come through, albeit in different media nowadays.
Yeah, I'm sure. I think it's true what you say, that while people don't write body copy in ads anymore, in press ads anymore, words still as important as they've ever been. It's just in different media, I guess. It's dialogue or, you know. I mean, for all, you know, if you think about famous ads, you know, the bit everyone remembers about Frank Budgen's PlayStation ad is the bit where the kid says, "I've conquered worlds," you know, it's words. And the bit everyone remembers from the Apple 1984 ad, maybe it's just me, the bit you remember from the Apple 1984 ad where the hammer's thrown into the screen is Big Brother saying a garden of pure ideology.
Yeah.
So it's still the word, you know, the words still have their place. They might not be set like a Ligus Delaney Timberland ad from 1989, but words are still important, and choosing the right ones and putting them in the right order. Like, well, I guess always be important.
I just wonder whether that's got lost a bit. I mean, I remember that there was a thing that they used to have on the screens of BBH that said words are a barrier to communication. Were you there when that was? You'd obviously taken it one step from the French Revolution quote. And I don't understand why, perhaps it's because I'm an art director, but I don't understand why there's such a, they're not as cherished as they used to be. Because I think superficially people don't realise that that people read more. They do read more than they used to.
Well, I'm sure it wasn't intended as a kind of blanket, you know, rule never to use words. Because, of course, they had to use words to express,
to
that,
express
thought,
that thought.
But
yeah.
Reminding you to think harder, and is there a way of using fewer words, or can you do it visually, or is always worth thinking about, I suppose. Because to your point about John Withers with his blue pencil, taking his blue pencil to David Abbott's copy, there are always, you can always find a way to take words out of whatever it is you need to take words out of.
Well, tweaks are a perfect example. Obviously, you need to understand how to shorten and construct things more than ever. I don't know who's got a blue pencil nowadays. Do you ever use a blue pencil on anyone's? No. So obviously at Abbott Mead, you're probably the most senior writer, I'm presuming.
The oldest, probably.
Yeah, that's what I meant. What did you mean? No, you're the most senior or awarded writer, and yet you're not doing what John Withers did or Alan Tilby did. And I wonder who's doing that now. Who's literally taking young writers through how you write, how you construct, how you shorten things. Because I don't see it. I don't see people wanting to be great with words.
Do you think that matters?
Yeah, because I think it's, you know, the words are, as you know, when we've just reflected on some of the ads that we've mentioned, I've conquered worlds.
Yeah.
The choice of those words is crucial. You know, I've seen a lot. I've been around a bit. I mean, that could have been various things, but to use words powerfully, I suppose it seems like it's only, it seems like in our business, we've discarded them a bit too early.
And yet, for all that, you know, I mean, I don't know what proportion of advertising is that yours or mine? I don't know what proportion of advertising is terrible, whether it's more terrible advertising now or less than it ever was. I know Tom McGallagher said he thought 99.5% of advertising was terrible.
When he was doing it?
Well, still.
Always, yeah.
Still, but good work still happens somehow, and whether it's because, I don't know, someone is still writing the right way. Whether it's because someone's going through their work at some stage with a blue pencil or not, or whether they just have an innate grasp of how to express themselves, or is somebody involved in the process says, what if we expressed it a different way? Good work still happens. So it's not as if every piece of advertising is illiterate or overwritten. Or
no, I suppose it's a certain kind of... I don't see lots of good work with the using words very powerfully. I mean, obviously, there is, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but it doesn't seem, it seems like they're just being overlooked, I suppose, a bit. I mean, even going back to your Isaac Newton is a great use of words. You know, you could have, as you could have written that like a headline, mm-hmm. but you've sort of reconstructed it in a more powerful form because of your understanding of words. Do you know what I mean? That could have been, you could have seen the thing in the Esquire and done a version of that, but truncating it into a new form makes it powerful. So to me, that's a really good use of words. It's not that you want lots of, may I dare suggest, you know, any of that kind of thing. But
who knows? Seems like the person who, well, who knows what's going to happen next, even since we've been recording this. But it seems at the moment like the person who understands how to use words in social media the best is Donald Trump, because whether you agree with him or not, and I suspect most people don't, but his use of Twitter probably won him the election. Well, if it's not the Russians, there's someone who, whether he's been taught to do that or just has an innate understanding of how to communicate, can get his point of view across. And
I mean, it's almost like he's got like a new brand voice, and he's got like a brand voice that you haven't seen in the way that he constructs things. It's so bizarre.
Yeah.
But sort of, it almost makes little sense when you read it, but somehow you get the, some kind of, I don't know, it's odd.
Yeah.
Disturbing, but odd. so one of the things more recently that I loved that you did was the Sainsbury's World War One ad, which took a lot of flack. And I thought, God, that's going to do amazingly at the awards. Because it's a really neat idea. It's positive. And I was just amazed that lots of people seemed to come out against it because it was about World War One. Now, my understanding is it gave over £1 million back to charity. And it was reverential. Was it half a million? And it was, it wasn't, why did some people take against that? Which must have affected it in the awards.
I don't know. I mean, maybe we should have done a better job of getting the story out. But I don't know. I mean, people are within their rights to find it in poor taste if they want. But my impression was that, you know, and this may be the last refuge of a scoundrel and all that, but my sense of it was that most of the public liked it. Some of the media had a go at it. And
it just seemed like people in our business were a bit sniffy.
Well, you know, that's fine. Lots of people, lots of ads that I'm sniffy about.
So, obviously, one of the accounts you've worked on for a long time, in fact, how many years have you worked on The Economist from beginning to end, probably?
Well, I went to MV in 1996, so that was kind of Economist heyday, and I think they stopped doing the White Out of Red poster campaign in 2007, 2008, so that's 12 years. And the brief came to the whole department twice a year. So, written quite a lot of ads for that. Not all that got through. And you may remember this from when you were there, that there'd always be bitter people, myself often among them, who'd say, well, I did that Economist idea 3 years ago and it was turned down and now someone else has done it and it's, you know, entirely coincidentally.
Yeah.
And it's got through. Or worst of all, it's won an award, you know.
It surprised me when I got there that the brief changed every time because essentially it was the same thing. So when I was there, it was, it sort of had slight variations each time rather than I would have imagined. I don't know if it changed as it went on, but they would come in with a slightly different skew, but you'd see the posters and not really notice.
I think it was probably more... That was more so agency and client thought they were contributing something to the process. But I think you're right that you could put almost any ad from any part in that campaign next to the one, another one, and they'd probably
it all hold together. I think perhaps when I was there, it was just going from that skew from being about finance and success to being socially successful, or you know, perhaps that was one of the changes.
I think if you look at the first few years, it's much more about financial success.
It's quite overt, isn't it?
Yeah, and after
honk,
that,
get your chauffeur to honk if he's was that one?
If you're already a reader, get your chauffeur to hoot as he passes.
Which is seems weird now.
That's probably kind of tongue in cheek, I think.
And one of the best ones, probably my favourite of your Economist posters, would be the Jordan one, which, for the kids today, probably means nothing. Jordan, is she still going?
Well, they might know who Katie Price is, but before Katie Price was... I guess, first of all, Katie Price was Katie Price, and then she was Jordan. But there was a thought about Ariel Sharon, who the kids also might not know, about people confusing Sharon with someone called Sharon. But then I thought, well... Jordan seems like an obvious thing to do. And the original line, I think, was... It's kind of a joke about Economist readers that they're so nerdy that they'd only think of Jordan in terms of the Middle East rather than popular culture. But I think the original line was something like, somebody mentions Jordan, you think of a small country in the Middle East. And the client said... Well, we don't want to be disrespectful towards Jordan, the country. I said, well, it is a small country. I said, well, couldn't you say something else about it? So, what else can you say? And I went on The Economist have a thing called a website called the Economist Intelligence Unit, which tells you everything about every country in the world. And I just kind of randomly looked at what its growth rate was. Which was 3.3%. And I think that actually improved the line. So the rhythm of the line is better, but also it amplifies the joke, I think, about Economist readers being nerdy because they even know what the growth rate is. So it kind of... what in other circumstances may have seemed like an annoying client comment actually improved the ad. So I guess there's... There's maybe a lesson there that sometimes the annoying feedback you get can sometimes actually improve the work, I think, because I would never have got to that without the client.
Sorry. Just get rid of your last bit.
You think that's rubbish?
No, I think... sorry. I think... I think that is a... I think you're sort of... It's weird. When you first come into the business, you're almost... trained to assume that anything the client says is obviously wrong. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the longer you've been in it, you realise that that's not true.
Well, I guess
you get a bit more confident. You get more confident enough to actually take on their issues rather than just think that can't be right.
I think also your instinct is to protect your work, as you know that there are so many factors that might harm the idea. You have to steer it through so many hoops that almost your natural reflex is to resist any attempts to change it. But occasionally, you know, it's worth listening because sometimes that can actually benefit the work, I think.
So you seem to, when I was there looking off The Economist, it seemed like people would dip in sporadically, they'd have a go, whereas you were there with every batch, you would have some in. You'd stick through it. I don't know if that was almost like a Leagues Delaney thing, but you were sort of always there. You wouldn't just dip in. You were always pushing to get some in there. Do you think that's a... There weren't many people who I think...
Really?
Yeah, I don't think so. People, it felt to me, this is how it felt, I would get, say, 150 posters. And sometimes, you know, I think it was 8 per batch that we kind of did. And sometimes you may pick 4, and some people would, at that point, just drop out the race. They'd go, well, I shot my bolt. That's me done. Whereas you would always keep pushing away. So consequently, how many Economist posters would you have done in that period, that 12 years?
I've no idea, but they're probably more the not make-weights, but the ones that you go, oh, yeah, that's an Economist poster, rather than the stellar ones. But it just seemed like it's easy to forget what an opportunity that was.
Yeah.
You know, and it's easy, you know, it's hard work to write an Economist poster, although some of the best ones look effortless. So it's always worth persevering, and I think. And also the other thing you learnt was that there'd always be one or two that fell out right at the last minute. So there'd always be the time when the account man or the CD came around and said, we need another Economist poster. So it was always worth keeping on, because you could probably always get one to run in every batch. And, you know, fingers crossed, one of them would be okay.
What was your favourite Economist poster written?
By
Not
anybody.
By you, by anybody.
The one that impressed me most at the time was was one that Richard Foster and John Horton did when they did the one that was just green, because that just seemed to me, I mean, maybe isn't that remarkable now, but at the time you just had 2 or 3 years of red and white Economist ads, and they did one where it was green rather than red. You just thought, oh, that's really clever that they've just taken a step back and thought, well, rather than what's the best headline we can write, what can we do visually with The Economist?
So they played with the medium a lot. They opened that up a lot, actually, didn't they? They did the
fly on the wall.
Two-thirds of the earth is water, the other Economist readers. Was that it? They did Keyhole, probably the first graphic one. I'd probably say, would you sit next to you at dinner or the edge of a conversation?
Would you sit next to you at dinner? It's good, And I liked E equals IQ squared, because that's one of those...
That was a great one, that. Hmm? That was great, though.
I don't know who did that. That was one of those ones that you just thought, why didn't I think of that? Why, you know, it's... Which is, you know, the sign of something really good, I think, is that it appears so simple when you see it, and yet clearly it's the...
It's a weird one with that. I remember saying to Sean, it'd be good to do an equation, you know, like an E equals MC squared. Now you think, if you can get to E equals MC squared, you can finish that off, which I couldn't think of anything. And then he said like that, which seemed amazing. But I also remember spending ages on the bus with a jigsaw piece, thinking that's a perfect graphic thing for The Economist. You could just see it. But I couldn't figure out what to do with it. And again, you look at the one that Matthew did.
Yeah, fantastic.
How could you think anything other than that?
Yeah, exactly.
But they look so easy, these things.
No, I, like you, I played around with
jigsaw puzzle visuals on a few occasions and could never work out how to make it work. And yet, you're right, when you see it now, it's obvious.
It's the first thing you do. Yeah. So on the Snickers Twitter ads that you did a couple of years ago that won awards, how did you start that? Did you start that in a different way than you would have done previously with a more traditional brief?
Well, that was a brief we inhabited. I mean, the You're Not You When You're Hungry, of course, is BBDO New York's idea. Thank you, BBDO New York. And when we first began working on it in the UK, the first work that was done on it was could we do any UK or Europe-specific TV? Which, for whatever reason, didn't see the light of day for a long time. But we were also asked, what other ways could you... You know, as you'd expect, what other ways were there of exploring the campaign in other media? And we did a whole raft of different stuff, from cover wraps. We actually had an idea very similar to the Australian one about the well-behaved construction workers, which never saw the light of day. And I'm sure people in other countries had ideas similar to ones that we've done. But one of the ones that was in that batch was, could you get people who were famous people on Twitter to tweet out of character? And it went nowhere for a while. It was in a presentation, and I think people said, yeah, it's a good idea, but nothing more happened. And then 6 months or 9 months later, Alex Nadrian, who at that stage were CDs on Mars, came in and said, you know that Twitter idea you had for Snickers? Well, they've got some budget. If we could get maybe 5 celebrities who weren't very expensive, do you reckon we could do it? So we gave it a try, and with the help of the account team, who were very smart, because the way I'd written it, I think I'd tried to be too clever and picked very niche people and wrote very, what I thought were very clever tweets, probably a bit esoteric. But the account team made a good point. They said, no, Twitter's all about fame, so you've got to pick the most famous people we can get for the money. I wasn't sure I agreed with them. But we managed to get 5 celebs, and there was a constantly changing lineup right up until a couple of days before the campaign ran. So we had Ian Botham was like a last-minute replacement, and the tweets I wrote for him weren't particularly funny, I didn't think. And the third person, who was kind of a late replacement for someone else, was Katie Price, who... we've mentioned earlier, I wrote an ad about her for The Economist, so it's becoming a bit of a recurring theme. But they said, well, we can get Katie Price. She's got 2 million followers on Twitter. And I said, well, really? I've done an ad about her before. It'll look like I haven't got any other ideas other than ones that are about Katie Price. I said, no, and the account team rightly said, no, we think it's worth doing because she's got all these followers. So I quickly wrote some tweets for her. They were sent to Katie Price, and she turned them down. She said, no, I'd never tweet that. So in desperation, because time was against me, I wrote 5 more, sent those over. She said yes to them. And the campaign ran. It was 5 different celebrities, 1 a day, for 5 days in a row. And the first two were, I forget who the first one was, Amir Khan. And Ian Botham, not much. And then on the third day, which was a Sunday afternoon, the Katie Price tweets appeared, I think over the course of an hour or something. And all of a sudden, there was a story on the Daily Mail website saying Katie Price's Twitter account's been hacked. So people really fell for it.
Brilliant.
In an amazing way. And the thing which I think really helped it was that Danny Alexander, who was standing in for George Osborne in Parliament, made a really poor joke about, because the tweets I'd written for Katie Price were about her being suddenly transformed into someone who knew about economics. And Danny Alexander in the House of Commons during the Chancellor's Q&A thing that week made some reference to Katie Price knows more about economics than Ed Balls does. And you just thought, well, that's just a gift. So when you're putting a case history film together, we put that right at the start, and suddenly it seemed like it got a bit of traction, but that makes it seem like a much bigger thing than it actually was. So, again, that just shows, I think, that your work can always be improved, and not just by CDs, that in that case, the account scene really helped, because I'd had the original idea, which is kind of a hackneyed old idea, people acting out of character. But not only did Alex and Adrian remember we'd had the idea 9 months previously, the account scene said to me, no, what you've written is too esoteric, you need to focus on big
scripts. It's all about numbers.
Yeah, it's all about numbers. And it didn't really work for the other four. Rio Ferdinand got some success. He was the one after Katie Price. But Katie Price, clearly, because she was always in tabloids, almost anything she does gets attention. And the fact that newspapers thought she'd been hacked was great. So there's that. But also, Katie Price herself didn't like the first batch of tweets I'd written for her. And in retrospect, she was right. They were trying too hard to be clever, and I just took a more simple approach, and that worked really well. So the lesson for me from that was that, you know, although your instinct is to try and protect your work and stop people changing it, quite often the changes that are forced upon you can actually improve the work, I think, or certainly help to make it more successful. So there's a lesson there, I think. Not always.
Would you have been open to that in the early days at BNP, or would you have been very protective?
No, like I say, I think your instinct is to, you know, you're taught to, well, not taught, but your instinct is that there'll be people who try and water down your ideas. And that's largely true, I think. You know, how often do we get feedback where the poor old account team come back and they say, client really loves the idea, can you just take out this bit, and you go, well, that is the idea. So I think, you know, we all hear that quite a lot, but just occasionally the feedback you get from the client can force you to think about it in a different way. And, you know, I suppose what we do is problem solving. So they're just giving you another problem to solve. So sometimes it does lead to a workable solution. The opposite of that, I suppose, is sometimes solutions just seem to be completely frictionless. When I worked at BNP with Peter Gausis, we had The Guardian as a client there. And one day we had to go to the Guardian offices. The account man said, we've got a tactical, they've got a new serialisation. We need to do a tactical ad in this weekend newspaper. Can you come to the Guardian and the client's going to brief us? We went, well, a tactical ad, you know, that's like the graveyard of ambition. But we got in the cab with the account man and went over there and met the Guardian client. It was a guy called John Gordon. And he said, oh, yeah, we've bought the rights to a serialisation of the H Block hunger strike, which happened in the early 80s, I think.
Yeah.
One for the kids, but basically IRA prisoners went on hunger strike. But the way that in the course of telling us about the inside story of the hunger strike, the client said, oh, yeah, one of the ways that the IRA on the outside communicated with the prisoners on the inside was cigarette papers. They'd write messages on the cigarette papers and the visitors going to see the prisoners would hide them, you know, in body cavities. They'd either put them up their arses or behind their foreskin, and then when they were searched going in, they wouldn't be discovered. And then the visitors were meeting the prisoners, they'd somehow smuggle it out and pass it across the table. The prisoners would then hide it themselves. They'd either put it in their mouths or whatever, so that when they were searched going back to their cells, it wouldn't be discovered. And we both sat there and thought, that's amazing. That's amazing.
In the cab,
as the guy was telling us it. And then the cab on the way back, we both just said, well, you just do a Rizla paper and write that as in as concise a form as you can on a Rizla paper and stick it on a page. Yeah. And that's your ad, surely. Will they buy it? Probably not, you know, but let's try. So We wrote it and described...
When you say stick it on a page, shoot it, and then...
Just shoot it.
No, I just wondered whether it was sort of a tip-on thing, but that shot...
Tip-on would have been nice. We didn't think of that. If only you'd been there then.
If only. If 25 only. Years too late.
So, I mean, that's a... That's one of those things that probably comes along once every 3 or 4 or 5 years, I don't know, where someone just tells you what the brief is and you think, well, that's brilliant. You just write that story on a Rizzler paper, shoot it on a big full page.
Big blank page, yeah.
Yeah, we did that, and the client, to his enormous credit, said, yeah, great, even though it had the word anus
No logo.
And it only ran once. And kind of forgot about it. And then the following year, Paul Leaves came back from DNAD judging. And the kind of the word go, you know, the people would rush up to him and say, what's got in, what's got in? And he said, oh, we've got a silver for press. And everyone's going, oh, what is it? What is it? What have we got? And he said, it was your guy. We'd almost forgotten about it. He said, it was your guardian had got in. And that was just a complete gift, you know. Yeah. Any team Any team presented with that brief would have done that ad, and yet it just fell into our lap. So
amazing. And there was no mention of Katie Price in that text at all.
No, I think it was probably pre-Price.
Blimey. Well done. Right, and we'll...
shortly after I'd started working with Joe Wenley, I think on a Thursday, we got... Alan Tilby came in and said, oh, could you two work on a pitch, a quick pitch for us? And we said, well, when's it wanted for? I said, well, Monday. And we said, oh, OK, yeah, who's it for? Derbyshire County Council. We said, what, Derbyshire County Council? And apparently what had happened was they'd seen that Margaret Thatcher and the Conservatives were about to abolish the GLC. And part of the reason they were going to succeed was because the GLC hadn't perhaps made enough of all the good things it did. So I think Derbyshire County Council thought, well, before we get abolished too, we're going to make sure that we spend some ratepayers' money bigging ourselves up, you know, saying these are all the great things they do. So we did the pitch very quickly, and we produced about 20 press ads, and we had to do a TV commercial for bus fares, and we sat there thinking, God, how do you do a... interesting TV ad about reduced bus fares for pensioners. And I remembered this joke that someone told me at primary school about someone who ran after a bus and every time it stopped asked the conductor how much the fare was to...
Right.
And it was only when it got to a certain point where she had enough money that she could get that. And we just thought, oh, well, that'll do. We'll write that up. That's the script. And we won the pitch. And they ran all the work, which never happens. This is how things were in the 1980s, kids. They ran all the work, and we shot that ad, and it got nominated for a pencil. So the first work I ever got in the book, apart from Thames Day, was a TV ad. Which, just, again, you know, is a massive stroke of luck, really.
Amazing. Did you do much of the Derbyshire County Council? I wonder why they'd spent such a lot of money. There's loads of ads in different awards books for them, Derbyshire County Council.
Did them all apart from... I went on holiday for 2 weeks and a brief came in, and so Joe worked with Frank Budgeon and did a really fantastic anti-drink driving campaign, probably the best work that was ever done on that campaign. So, but then Frank Budgeon, you're not going to compete with him, I don't think.
How was he there? Did you have to... work into Frank?
Never worked into him. No, he was, to begin with, he was part of a team with Bill Gallagher. They were quite quiet. And then he worked quite a lot with John Webster. So as everyone I think knows, they did the Points of View commercial together for The Guardian. And they did, maybe it would have been the third John Smith's campaign. So I think the first campaign was done by Webster in the late 70s. The second one was done in the early 80s. And then the third one he did with Frank would have been late 80s. And one of those, very simple one, Frank said, oh, I'd like to have a go at directing. I think it was just a very simple pullback where the Arkwright character is, you think he's talking to his wife about how much he loves her.
Right.
And you pull back and reveal that he's talking to a can of beer. And at the time, I think, a couple of people in the department said, you know, a nice directing job, Frank, just to pull back little did they know, you know, what he'd go on to do. Well, you asked about the John Smith's campaign earlier on. We did a bad thing there. We entered it 2 years running because the first year we entered it and Dinny D didn't get in.
Yeah. In the days when that seemed to be so crazy and wrong compared to what's happening now, that seemed...
So what we did was we entered. We didn't even tell the agency we'd entered it. We entered it as we paid to enter it ourselves, and it won a pencil. And rather than get told off by the agency, they said, "Well, well done. We'd better refund your entry then, hadn't we?"
Oh, really?
But I guess in those days there wasn't the same kind of documentation of work. So I mean, that campaign only ran in the South for a month. So if you hadn't seen it when it ran, you'd never have known if it appeared.
Well, I think that was also rumoured that the, was it Robinson's BBH, was supposedly entered, didn't get in, entered again the next year and won gold.
Yeah. So just keep entering.
It seems like a minor misdemeanour compared to what happens now. You know, that would be...
That makes me feel better.
Well, probably... well, I can remember people sort of... blowing up proofs, you know, so the ad would run at A4 and it would be proofed at A3, and that felt like you were some criminal really living on the edge.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously you see what's happening now, it doesn't compare.
Well, what you said about this work we can't change, these clients will always do terrible stuff, but we've got this work here that we can enter for awards, seems the wrong way of doing it, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
The idea you can just corral off a budget to... What's the point?
On that positive note. Thanks for coming in.
Okay.
Great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.